This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, we'll take you to the official opening of Cape Breton's first hospice. Also, we'll have the mayor on the program talking about a proposed grant that will give a boost to the arts community. And on The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall chats with the CBU Athletics Director. These stories are coming up on the Coast. An official opening for the island's first hospice recently took place in Membertou. The construction of the 10-bed, $5.4 million facility was led by Hospice Cape Breton. The work started late in the summer last year. The Coast was there for the ceremony, and the event got underway with an honor song by David Muse, Membertou's cultural ambassador. Hospice Cape Breton co-chair Irene Cater was the master of ceremonies.
So the society, as you can appreciate, is grateful to so very many. The support we've received from our community has been phenomenal, and none more so than our next speaker. One of the first to come on board with their support was the Membertou Development Corporation. They provided this beautiful piece of land. They cleared it and readied it for construction. Chief Paul, if you could say a few words, please.
It feels like a long time coming for the grand opening of this beautiful residence, which will hold such a special place for so many families in Cape Breton, Unamagi. To those who work, to work here daily, and those who will need the comfort and services it provides, I extend my gratitude and care to you. May you always remember the impact that you're making. Each one of us hopes to leave a legacy, no matter how big or small. And the hospice residence honors everyone who enters its doors, fulfilling their needs and legacies in a respectful and a dignified manner. Congratulations on this incredible location. Bellagio, Bellagio.
Over the last number of years, we've also worked very closely with the Nova Scotia Health Authority. I now ask Brett McDougall, who is the Executive Director of Health Services for the Eastern Zone, to come forward.
It was the Hospice Society of Cape Breton County, a vision, a collaboration of leaders across the communities who work together to come together to begin to plan, set goals, and create and deliver on the vision from the Hospice Palliative Care Society here. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the partners, partnerships, and people involved to help make this day happen. I'd like to extend a thanks to the Hospice Palliative Care Society of Cape Breton. Today is your day. Congratulations. The new hospice is a natural extension of the partnership between Palliative Care Hospice and the Hospice Palliative Care Society. It will be a special place filled with compassion, comfort, and support for patients and families transitioning into this end-of-life episode of care. The staff and physicians and volunteers within the palliative care service look forward to providing care in such a fabulous, fantastic care environment. And I just want to again thank everyone involved here today. It's hard to mention all the people and acknowledge everyone, but thank you.
We're also very fortunate to have had the benefit of another partnership through the years, and it is the one we have forged with the Nova Scotia Health Authority's palliative care service. One person that has become familiar through the years as a palliative care professional, volunteer, advocate, and knowledge sharer of the palliative care philosophy and its impact on, for patients and families is Dr. Ann Frances Dentino. Well, what a wonderful day. Welcome, everyone. Today, we are witnessing a truly compassionate community in action. And here we are, all of you. Without you, this day would not be possible. It will provide patient, person-centered care, dignified care for those who need it most, focusing on what matters most at this time, easing not only physical symptoms, but also providing a sense of well-being and fulfillment. Those who know me know that I'm rarely at a loss for words. But today, words are simply not enough to express the deep gratitude I feel for all the members, past and present, of the Hospice Palliative Care Society of Cape Breton, for their courage, strength, and determination to hold on to a vision of not what could be, but what will be. I'd like to close today with a well-known quote from Dame Cicely Saunders, the founder of the modern-day hospice movement that guides our work in hospice palliative care. You matter because you are you. And you matter to the end of your life. And we will do all we can not only to help you die peacefully, but to live until you die. Our next two speakers quite literally need no introduction. They have been the faces of our fundraising campaign from the outset. Raising $5 million is no easy task, yet Brian and Monica Shabib made it look like it was. They are warm, they are welcoming, and luckily for us, very persuasive. I'm proud to introduce our fundraising co-chairs and loyal friends of hospice, Brian and Monica Shabib.
It's such a pleasure for us to be here. This day has been long, a long time coming, and we have been so privileged to be part of the journey. The construction of this hospice was truly a collective effort. When we were approached to take on the role of leading the fundraising campaign, we were presented with a much different financing model that required a contribution from the society and a campaign goal of $1.5 million. Not long in, the ground rules changed and the society... And if the society wanted a hospice, they would have to pay for it. The new campaign goal became $5.2 million. And as is the case with most projects, plans and costs change, and we now stand before the $5.4 million. There's no question that raising funds can be challenging. Throw a global pandemic in the mix, and the challenges become even more pronounced. While we were facing change, there was one constant: the generosity of our donors and how deeply people cared about this project and the work the society does. That sense of caring often extended beyond our borders. We have some people here from Alberta even. And many who once called the island home, or would like to call it home once again, gave to this very important project. Our gratitude runs deep.
When Brian and I knocked on doors and explained just why we were raising funds, the response was heartwarming. People simply wanted to help and to tell their story. End-of-life care is not as easy a subject for many, but it is an important one. So many could relate because a loved one received palliative care at home, spent time on the Oncology Unit. The impact was both profound and deeply felt, and actually made our job rewarding. Whether large or small, every donation matters, and every donation mattered to the people who gave it. Throughout the facility, you will see the names of so many generous donors. They stand as a lasting tribute to those who have made this day possible.
One of the things that struck us as the campaign progressed was how notice was made of the scarves Monica chose to wear on the TV commercials. People were truly paying attention. There's no doubt, however, that attention led to action, and we thank you. We both want to acknowledge and thank Patricia, Nancy, Irene, and the board for their unwavering efforts in making this day possible. We also want to thank Executive Director Aurel Landry, who did almost everything, Pam Ellsworth, who started us off on the right track, Michelle McKinnon, who did her best to make us sound good, and staff members Kathy Forsey and Alicia McIntosh, who supported us throughout the campaign.
As you know, and as we've been saying, there are so many people who can be credited with taking us along on this journey. But at this moment, I have the pleasure of introducing two individuals who have been involved and engaged from the outset. Patricia Jackson, co-chair of Hospice Cape Breton and co-chair of the Hospice Build, she's a busy woman, is another of our pioneers. Another of our most ardent advocates is Nancy Dingwall, former board chair and co-chair of our Build Committee.
We'd like to begin by acknowledging our pioneers and founding members of the Society, some of whom are with us here today. Pam Seville, Suzanne Murner, Bernice McDonald, and Carolyn Fiolik online, and Patricia Jackson. We also want to acknowledge and thank Dale Orchuk and John Malcolm. Their dedication to this cause began over 30 years ago, and their efforts have been instrumental as we have progressed forward in providing integrated palliative care services for our community. We would also like to thank all former and current board members and our incredible staff, Aurel Landry, Kathy Forsey, and Alicia McIntosh. We are so lucky to have you.
Hospice Cape Breton is a result of extraordinary effort and teamwork. Thousands upon thousands of hours dedicated by so many at so many phases. We are deeply grateful to the leaders of our campaign team, Monica and Brian. You took on a daunting task raising funds for this amazing facility with grace and generosity and never expected a pandemic to impact your extraordinary efforts. Your commitment has helped to make it possible for us to officially open these doors today. As we mentioned, it's the realization of a long-held dream. Hospice Cape Breton allows us to complete the circle of care. Integrated palliative care services delivered at home, in long-term care, in hospitals, in Oncala, and now Hospice Cape Breton. This is the circle complete, but it does not end. Rather, it is another beginning. Before we officially open the doors of this beautiful building, we'd like to share a blessing of peace, a blessing of hope, a blessing of love, a blessing of compassion, and a blessing of gratitude to all who enter Hospice Cape Breton.
Thank you hardly seems enough. You're both so very much loved, appreciated, treasured, and respected. Our hearts are full with pride at what you have achieved and the leadership you have provided. So as a demonstration of our immeasurable gratitude, we'd like to present you with a small gift of appreciation. It cannot come close to conveying how truly indebted the Society is to you both, but I hope it acts, and we hope it acts, as a reminder of our heartfelt thanks. I'd also like Aurel Landry, the Society's Executive Director, to join us for a moment and accept the same gift. None of us will ever know, perhaps with the exception of his wife, Carol, the countless hours and sleepless nights this fine man has given to the Society, its mission, and this project in particular. So, Aurel and Nancy.
So that is a condensed version of the official opening for the island's first hospice located in Member 2. The event was emceed by co-chair Irene Cater. We had to do some editing for time, but the entire event is posted on the Hospice Cape Breton Facebook page. And if you watch it there, you'll notice the ceremony has much more levity than this version we played, and more praise for the countless people who were there to make it happen. And you can find that full video at facebook.com/hospicecapebreton. On The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall chats with CBU Athletics Director John Ryan about weathering COVID-19 this past year and what's going on with athletics at the university.
So John's been a heck of a year. He just went through with COVID. And also, before we get into what's new with sports and athletics at CBU, give us a rundown on how things went the past year.
Well, as you said, it's challenging. You know, in sports, we usually like to have game plans, Paul, but with COVID, there certainly wasn't one. We've kind of managed day to day, and the landscape changes week to week. So communication has been important regionally within our Atlantic University Sport Office, but also nationally with U Sports. So definitely was a challenge not to have sports for 18 months. I mean, it's our passion, but also our livelihood. So we really missed it. And having the student athletes here on campus really is the most important part of our job, right? So we missed that. But I think we managed it very good. We engaged the student athletes, even though they were back in their own cities or countries, kept in constant communication and kept them involved and engaged with Capers Athletics. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about the renovations that were done here at CBU, but really use that downtime with no students to really take advantage of some necessary renovations at our facilities. But we're happy to be back and see an action here on campus, and we have a lot of good, exciting announcements to be made here shortly in terms of our work with U Sports and national championships that will be coming to our community.
Yeah, no, it all things sound really terrific, and I've seen the field house and that, which we'll talk about in a minute. Some of the athletes, though, last year were still in the local area because they're studying, doing the distance online. So yeah, some of them were in.
We did, yeah, things. Working with senior administration. Our return to campus, we're able to bring back our winter sport athletes. So our basketball teams were on campus because there was a glimmer of hope. Maybe in the winter months, we'd be able to do some competition. But unfortunately, again, just some things flared up at the wrong time, and we weren't able to do that. But the winter student athletes were on campus and were able to train with their head coaches and then take their courses online. So kind of the best of both worlds. And I think it was advantageous for those teams to have them here just for chemistry and continuity for this year's program.
For our Coast listeners, I do my day job is teaching public health at CBU, but I was over to see the field house and the new floor. Tell us about it.
It's been exciting. 1974, the field house, well, actually 78, sorry, the field house was built in 78. Really the first time we painted the field house since 1978 from top to bottom. And even that made a huge difference, right? Having the ceiling painted white, again, working with our facilities a management team and the leadership of David Dingwall, we were able to really do a full facelift of the field house, right, with three new floors all refinished and painted. The murals in there just jump off the walls, right, and and there's still some work. We got new video boards coming here shortly to really elevate the experience of our fans, and some new bleachers coming to close in the main courts. And then we have a game day curtain that'll be put in place for game days as well, right? So we really elevated our field house to probably one of the best facilities in the country for basketball. And I know our coaches, our student athletes, we're excited to get back and see that. And I think the community will love coming back to watch the play in that first-class facility.
It's one of those weird things. Timing is everything, because I don't know if you could have been able to like squeeze that in over, you know, 4 month periods and summers and that. It would have taken years.
No, exactly. Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, it was a good vision by the president in terms of using that. Unfortunately, the pandemic to get some of this work done. Right, the pit lounge is unbelievable as well, as we know now here on campus, and the field house, and we're doing some current work for the soccer facility as well with the national championships coming in November. So. Phase two is like we like to work in our team rooms as well in the field house and at the soccer complex as well as kind of our phase two of the of renovations that hopefully will start this spring.
The floor too, I was like the beautiful mural there of our, you know, of the island. How do they do that? Do they paint that into the floor?
Well, it's all stained. It's a darker stain that we use. So yeah, we've seen that again. We see that south of the border at some of the schools.
Yes.
And we just thought, again, we represent the whole island, right?
Right.
Some student-athletes play for a city. We play for the whole island.
Yeah.
So it was nice to have the island on the floor, right, in terms of they see that every day in practice and the games, that you're not you represent your family, our teams, but also the island when you put on that Capers jersey. So, yeah, it really jumps off the floor. Really, it's really spectacular.
The whole place is so bright.
Yeah, the new lights came a couple of years ago. We have the new LED lights up there now, and they're all timed. And these video boards will allow us to really enhance the experience, right, with starting lineups and sponsor engagement and bring us more into the new era, for sure.
For sure. But the light thing, I remember in there maybe 4 or 5 years ago in the middle of a game and all the lights go out.
Yeah.
And you think, well, power failure or this or that. All it was someone leaned against a light switch over by the entrance that leads into the rest of CBU. They figure, oh, I just turned all the lights off from a switch, right? It took 20 minutes once you turn the switch back on.
Yeah, it was about a half hour delay by the time we cool them down and warm them back up again, right?
Yeah.
It was during a women's game, and we know Coach McKenzie, how intense he can get during a game. So I said to myself, oh my God, if we lose this game, he'll be coming after me. But fortunately, we pulled it out.
Because
they had the lead and they had the momentum, and then the lights go out, right?
That's right. I remember that one. Gone are the days of those kind of technical issues.
Yeah, for sure.
So basketball will, you recently had with the women's a couple of exhibition games.
We do have some more games coming up on the 17th of October for both basketball teams here at home.
Yeah.
Exhibition season started for basketball. Soccer season is now a full tilt, and our basketball regular season will start at the end of October.
Yeah, so with the soccer, the men's and the women's, so they're off to a good start. Of course, predict it. Right now, as we're speaking, the women are still ranked one, right?
Yeah, no, they're both in the top five.
Top five,
the men fell to number three, and the women are five.
The women are five.
The men were number one a week or so ago until they had that loss at UMB.
Yeah.
But both teams were our top five team in the country, which is fantastic, right? I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, it comes down to that weekend in November,
That's right.
We know. But for an administrator and for the university to have teams nationally ranked, it helps in terms of recruiting and building the program, right?
Definitely.
So Ness has been a top 10 team at least once throughout the year for 18 straight years, right? And then Dino men's soccer now, they've been ranked number one in the country 3 of the last 4 years at one time or another. So that's, again, information that we can use when we're selling our program to future student athletes.
Exactly. And that weekend in November, of course, is the AUS finals, which, because it goes by the past champion get to host it again.
That's right.
So in this case, it's both.
Yeah, no, this will be the third straight year that we'll host both. So we have 12 teams coming to Sydney. First weekend in November, we have 6 women and 6 men, and hosting both. I mean, no school has ever done that, and we've done it now 3 straight years. So I don't know if the conference will maybe relook at that motion or not, but we're excited to do so. And And again, we've done some good renovations to our soccer complex as well, with new dugouts, new nets. The whole fence will be wrapped here over the next week. Had a chance to really promote the history of the programs with a bleacher, a banner, and then the lower complex of the facility is going to be rebranded as well before the national championship. So, again, trying to provide a great environment for our players, but also for the fans to come out and support the Capers.
And there's two press kind of viewing areas now on either side.
Brand new media center, which media is great. And then we've outsourced our webcasting and Nova Stream, and Darcy and Hib team have done a fantastic. It's really made it more professional, and the feedback we received is second to none. So, again, all that just elevates the experience of our student athletes and to future students to come here.
So that's first week in November?
First weekend in November with the AUS, and then there's a week off, and then the national championships will start the week of November 15th to 19th, or that week of November 15th. So,
which we have for the ladies.
Yeah, for the women's national championships will be held here in November. The top eight teams in the country will be coming to Sydney and to CBU. So really exciting. They pushed it back a week due to some of the conferences getting away a little later this year because of the pandemic. So we have a week off. Most conferences play right up until the Sunday before the national championship. So a week later, November in terms of Mother Nature and weather, hopefully everything bodes well. But we're excited to bring it here. And then in 2023, the men's nationals will be here as well. So
that's just 2 years for that one.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so that's... That's all really exciting. You know, it's great to, this is the soccer place, Cape Breton. You've got, you know, a fan base that comes out all the time.
Yeah.
And then when you get closer to championships like that, I've been there when the stands are full.
Oh, yeah, they're full for sure, right? And we know Cape Breton fans, they love the events and they love a winner. And the soccer programs have both been very, very competitive. So we hosted in 2007 Women's Nationals And unfortunately, we had to play in New Waterford just because of our grass field, and we had sellouts every game, and it was ideal because our women's got to the final and won it. Yeah. So it was kind of a storybook ending for us for sure. So I said no pressure to Ness to do that again this year.
Speaking of New Waterford, it's quite the field out there.
It is, yeah. It's a tribute to the work done by Lowell Cormier and his team out there, right, to have state-of-the-art facilities in a small town of New Waterford, right? They're the envy of it. A lot of smaller communities around the province, right? Fantastic facilities, and we were lucky to be out there to open it up, playing against St. Evex to do our part to help the town in New Waterford because they do so much for us here at the university.
Yeah, and it's good to, it is a backup field in case for any reason.
Yeah, no, state-of-the-art turf. It's the best turf in town, right? Yeah. For sure now with that new facility, I think the Patriots play on the same turf in New England, right? But it's a great facility, and it's nice to have that and the open hearth. There's a couple backup facilities there for turf if we need it, but all the games will be played here on campus. But if we do need practice facilities or something else besides what we can handle, then it's nice to have those turf fields available.
Is the schedule, I know a couple of years ago things kind of changed with the soccer where they was like Thursday, then Saturday, Sunday, or something. You kind of had a day off,
The AUS still do.
They
play Thursday, Friday, off Saturday, and the finals are on Sunday.
Yeah,
right. So the AUS will be that way, but the Nationals isn't. The Nationals is Thursday to Sunday, but their games each day.
Each day.
Yeah, the Thursday of the Nationals is the busiest day. That's when all eight teams play.
Right.
And then it goes by if you win or lose. It goes to the championship draw or the consolation draw.
I'm going to ask you then what you think of the AUS with the day off from two points of view. One, coach and players, and two, fans. So what do you of that?
Yeah, I think for coach and players, if you make the final, they enjoy it because you have that day off, right? And now on the men's side of soccer, both finalists go to the national championship. On the women's side, it's not...
Right,
this year we're going to the Nationals no matter what because we're hosting.
Yeah.
So if we make the final, then whoever we play will go as well.
Right.
Right to the national championship. So the biggest thing for the day off is that they thought three straight days was a lot of competition. Then usually had to fly right away out west or wherever the national championships were, right? So they were beat up going out. So in order to give the teams the best chance to compete at the national level, they thought having that day off gave them that advantage.
Right.
From a fan's perspective, I think it's not good. because you build momentum Thursday, Friday, and then you're off for a whole day,
right,
and then try to get them back on that Sunday, which has been difficult. From a university perspective, it's worked out a little bit because usually we have the fall convocation on that Saturday, right? So we're able to have that Saturday
That's
off
right.
of competition. We have the fall convocation that takes place that day. So
timing is everything.
Yeah, timing seems to be everything.
Good.
So it's bad from our perspective because before we used to have a really nice banquet.
Yes.
And the banquet was always held on Thursday night
right.
before the event would start.
Yeah.
But what sacrifice for having that day off on Saturday was taking the banquet away from the student athletes, right? So we honor them before games with their all-conference awards. But I know on the female side, talking to Ness, that's something that he really enjoyed was having that first-class banquet to celebrate the success throughout the year.
Yeah, for sure. And because those events are always done so nicely.
Yes.
There's no doubt there. So with the male and female, then I guess there's games in the day, in the evening, under the lights?
Under the lights, yep. Yeah. Yep. For all day, Thursday, Friday, they're four games both days, right? So there's lights start noon hour and run right through till 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So it's a heavy load of soccer, especially with the 12 teams. And then Sunday, there's only the two games because of the two finals. But it's heavy on the front end on Thursday and Friday. And the national championships, the busiest day will be Thursday. All eight teams will play on Thursday.
Right.
And then there'll be not as many games throughout the rest of the week because of the championship draw and the consolation draw.
Yeah, so that that final game on the Sunday then for the women, if the Capers are in it, whoever they're playing is going to advance.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
If the Capers weren't in it, but we will be in it.
Yeah.
But if we weren't, then only the winner.
So
that could be, whereas the men...
The two finalists,
one of which will be the Capers.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
They're being very
We're
positive.
Hoping. Yeah, yes. No, we're hoping for sure, right? But, I mean, it's nice to play at home. That's always a competitive advantage, home field advantage. So they enjoy that for sure. And I think with the leadership of Dino Morley and Ness Timmons and... I think our teams will be well positioned in November to take another run at it.
Well, that's terrific. And then, we mentioned a bit about the women's basketball.
Yeah.
And Fabian, the coach, of course, was in Hungary with the under-19 team.
Yes.
And we're hoping to actually talk to Fabian in another interview about that experience. And they came fifth, right, out of
I mean, he's had a great run. It's been 13 or 14 years now with the national team program.
Yeah.
And Fabian from the Sterling Road, I always say, from Glace Bay, has done fantastic, right? One of the best coaches in the country and a big asset for the university, right? And have him to travel the world, representing Canada, but also representing CBU. It's a nice feather in his hat. And the experience that he was able to get from these trips and bring back to our program is second to none.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, he's really made a great profession for himself.
And a longtime Leafs fan.
Yes, yeah, no, exactly, for sure.
He isn't that.
No, definitely. He's
anyway.
Tracking you and I down when they lose.
I know.
Yeah.
And so what about Matt Skinn and the men's team?
Yeah, no, I'm really excited for this program, right? I mean, Matt's been back now for 3 years with us, and he's done a good job each year kind of elevating the program. So I think he should be right in the mix. I think St. Evex and Dalhousie will be strong, and I think Cape Breton University will be right there with them. And he's added some nice pieces, and we have 2 6-foot-11 guys, and they're always the fans, the community love seeing them. We had our Member 2 Open golf tournament, and one of them was working one of the holes, and I don't know how many pictures was taken by the community with him, 6'11", and he's not very big, so he looks taller than he is. But I think Matt Ozzy is back, our leading scorer and a perennial first-team All-Star and probably an All-Canadian, and hopefully Paul Watson, he's injured right now, but hopefully he'll be back. And so they have a good mix of veteran and some new young blood, so exciting to see them play. I watched them in exhibition, and I think, I think come March, they should be right there in the mix.
What's it going to be like when X comes up here and there's no Coach Gonchowski?
Yeah, it'll be different, right?
Yeah.
40 years seeing Coach K on the sidelines, right? Yeah. So it'll be a different for him and different for St. of X. I mean, I think the rivalry will still be there. Tyrell Vernon. So he was kind of the associate coach the last couple
up.
Years. So he just moved up.
Yeah.
They brought him kind of as a coach in waiting.
Yeah.
So he's taken over and he played there, and he's got lots of good recruiting connections being from Ontario. So they'll be strong, but it'll definitely be different not seeing Coach K in his calm self on the sideline.
Well, I was going to say, it was always when Jimmy Charters was here coaching the men, and X was in town, it was more, I think more people were in the stands to watch the antics between the two of them.
Yeah, but like, I mean, they were both top five programs back then. Yeah, they always called it the Duke North Carolina of the States was us versus X back then when Jimmy was our coach. Because, again, I never wore a shirt and tie. I always had to wear a referee shirt to make sure I was there in case Jimmy and Coach K went at each other.
Yeah, no. That's great. Well, that's an excellent wrap-up of what went on in kind of the past year and where we're heading in the next few months. Soccer is pretty well every second weekend here for our listeners. You just bring your proof of vaccination and you're going to get into the soccer games. Basketball is starting really soon with exhibition, and then the season starts in November. We got three championships. Yeah. Two-way USs and then the Nationals, so that there's no shortage of sports from CBU and...
Yeah, and if I can, Paul, just to the listeners, please come out and support the Capers. We're really working to elevate the experience. We have some pregame events going on in the pit before all the games and the postgame celebration as well, so really trying to make this kind of the place to be. So not only is it high-level sports, we're really trying to make it more of an experience so that it's more than just a game, so... Please come out and support your Capers. We'd love to see you.
Exactly. That's it. John Ryan, thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
Regional municipality could be providing local artists with grants by next year. They are considering a proposal that would have the municipality invest $50,000 a year for 3 years. It would allow the municipality award between $500 to $2,500 to 50 artists every year, and that will help them tap into the provincial and federal funding that can become available. Mayor Amanda McDougall.
If I could, I'd like to go back a little bit before the meeting in council. So this conversation started many, many years ago with a creative economy kind of working group that was brought together by the municipality to figure out what is the best way that the CBRM can support the creative sector. And so many people like Joella Folds, who chaired that committee, folks from every nook and cranny of the creative sector came together and did that really hard work a number of years ago. So skip to this year after I was elected, I had the opportunity to sit down with some folks from the creative sector and really dig into, okay, what if there was some sort of low-hanging fruit, what would it be that the CBRM could do to really help kickstart the careers of creative folk in the community? And they said, you know, you only need to look to Newfoundland and St. John's and what they do there. They have a municipal program that offers small grants, so typically between $5 and $2,500. I think they've gone up to $5,000 at points. But, yeah, small grants that allow artists to create the portfolio that they need to then access the higher levels of government funding. So that's where the conversation began. And what came to council was a proposal for a three-year pilot, $50,000 a year, a peer-reviewed jury of local artists that would come together and help administer these grants, all working through our regional enterprise network at the partnership.
And a presentation was provided for council at the recent council meeting, and that was by Nelson McDonald for Grassfire Films, and he spoke on behalf of a number of artists in the community. And one of those slides, I think there was a list, there's dozens of local artists. Do you think people would be surprised to know how big the local arts community is here in the CBRM?
Do you know what? Yes and no. I think for the most part, residents know how creative and really truly incredible our creative sector is. But when you see it on paper, when you see it was actually three slides of the smallest font possible to incorporate all of the artists that endorsed this proposal just from the CBRM, it really opens your eyes to think, wow, not only are these people incredibly talented, but these are all entrepreneurs. You know, these are all small businesses in essence. And you realize how far-reaching this economy, because it truly is the creative economy, how far-reaching that economy is here in CBRM.
Nelson had talked about a number of things, one of them being that this program would provide trigger funding that would allow local artists to maybe step up and approach some federal and provincial funding as well. Can you talk about that, please?
Exactly. So it doesn't really matter what sector you talk about. When we talk about providing funding to perhaps, say, organizations for buildings and programming, we always like to say we want to use municipal money to leverage other levels of government. So what Nelson was explaining through this project is it's actually bigger than just leveraging money. It's this money from the municipality is, it's a nod to say we value what you're doing, we stand behind you, and we want to see you succeed. And that means a lot when you go to the different arts councils. If they're seeing the municipality support your work, your project, that bodes well for accessing more money. So, for example, Nelson spoke about Ashley, who is from New Waterford, and Ashley accessed $2,100 to begin production on a film. That $21 then helped her get $250,000. So $250,000, I think it was from one of the film boards, to film a movie called Werewolf. It was completely filmed, produced here on Cape Breton Island, primarily in New Waterford and Glace Bay. All of that money was then spent here. So hiring folks to do production, videography, actors, paying for hotels, using restaurants, you name it. That money stayed here on the island. So that movie then went on to many film festivals internationally. The accolades came through. You know, Ashley is known as a shining light in the film industry. And that then led to an $800,000 opportunity for her to film another movie. And that was actually filmed here as well. So another $800,000 into our local economy. And she wrapped up just before COVID, so hoping that would be released quite soon. But so this is the example. This is what's happening when small amounts of money are provided to artists to then let them be creative and prove their talent so they can access the really big grants that are out there.
And I think Nelson and Council discussed, too, with Ashley McKenzie, that she won a $100,000 award, and I think that was through the Toronto Film Critics Association. But Nelson had explained that not only was this a boost for her resume, but she moved back to Cape Breton because she has family
back
here.
Home. Yeah. Exactly. So making her career sustainable and coming back home. So with any sector, with any opportunity for employment, we know now, especially more than ever after COVID, if you're able to work at home and have this quality of life that Cape Breton really doesn't, nowhere else in the world compares to. We know that. The space, the nature, the people, the opportunity. I had the opportunity while I worked at CBU to work with a tremendous amount of newcomers here, and they said repeatedly, you know, Cape Breton is a blank slate. There's so much that we can tap into creatively. You don't understand what you have in front of you. So it's this circular economy. We use that a lot when we talk about garbage, but it's this circular economy of taking care of one another and bringing people home and supporting them in their endeavors.
This program would provide, you know, fewer funding than what Ashley had experienced with her two films, but it was interesting what was discussed there, that this isn't necessarily for someone like Ashley McKenzie, but for the next Ashley McKenzie. And are there a lot of them out there in the CBRM?
Listen, you only need to go to a show at the Savoy or the Hat or the, like, the young generation is so wildly talented and creative, and this is our opportunity to embrace that creativity and let them know that, you know, we are here to help kick off that career, and this is how we can start. I know it seems small, between $500 and $2,500, but, you know, Deputy Mayor Earlene McMullen, if anybody has the opportunity to go back and watch the council video, she explained how $1,000 can change someone's life. And she used her own story of being able to use $1,000 to go to school, and look at her now, right? It's a remarkable story if anybody has an opportunity.
You know, speaking of the Hat, it was also mentioned that the Highland Arts Theatre in Savoy, not to mention festivals like the Celtic Colours and Lumiere, do you think this program will help revitalize those facilities and those events that were affected by COVID-19?
100%. So we think of the venues, we think of the festivals, but you need to have creative people who are going to fill those venues and who are going to populate those festivals and bring people in. This is a way to support and nurture the artists so that they can continue using our amazing assets that we have here within the CBRM.
You know, there are many talented local artists out there. They feel their art, maybe it's just at the hobby level right now, but they want to step it up and make it a full-time job. Can this be a realistic goal for a lot of the struggling artists that are out here?
I believe so, and that's why the three-year ask was important, because working through our regional enterprise network, who will be, you know, more or less administrating the dollars, I guess you could say, making sure the program actually runs smoothly and providing support to the jury, we're going to be tracking. We're going to be tracking what this money does, where it goes, and really how far it reaches. So I'm very hopeful and excited to see what happens after 3 years of this type of programming.
Can you talk about how this would allow tourists as well to see the community on a different kind of landscape? What do you think is unique about the art scene here compared to other communities roughly this size?
Listen, anybody who lives on an island, I don't know. There's something about island people that have this wild imagination and creativity, and it's perhaps because we do live surrounded by ocean and we're not as connected to other land. But look at St. John's. Look at Nashville. When you have government that identifies and supports the creative sectors, that's what drives your economy. And it becomes more than an economy. It just enhances the cultural experience, not only for those who live here, but those who visit. So we have the opportunity. This is a small contribution that's going to lead to big, big, big investment in the future, I'm sure.
Speaking of the artists, I think a lot would say they're not doing this for a financial reward, but material is very expensive. Film equipment is very expensive to rent if you're not lucky enough to own some of that. Could you speak to that, please? How expensive is it for an artist to be able to showcase their craft?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, Steve Wadden, who's a photographer, originally from Glace Bay, lives in Sydney, you know, he spoke about this throughout our meetings leading up to this proposal. And being able to take your work and put it out there and perhaps have a show or buy the materials. I mean, photography, think about cameras, lenses, the printing of your work, making it, putting it into the form that it's presentable and ready for a show, it all costs a tremendous amount of money. In the presentation that we received from Nelson, he spoke about Allison Uma, who's an artist from Sydney, a graphic artist, and she was able to access a small grant similar to what we are hoping to offer, to buy materials so she could do her first presentation at Lumiere. From that, she was able to create a portfolio, then apply for more money to do a graphic novel. That graphic novel got her a bit of attention and showed her creative talents. Then we see Island Folk Cider House, a new business, say, "Hey, Allison, your artwork is amazing and unique. Can you create the images for my cans? I want them to stand out on the shelf." And then we had this quote from Jill McPherson, who is the owner of Island Folk Cider House, saying it is because of, you know, the product, obviously, that she's producing in terms of cider, combined with the amazing creative artwork that Allison Uma came up with for the cans, that her business is really just thriving. So it makes her stand apart from all the other cans in the store, and people are interested. So that's it. This is what happens when an artist is provided a small grant to get off the ground. Big things come.
So like you said, this could be the beginning of bigger things to come. Unfortunately, a lot of the local artists, they must travel abroad to study and develop their skills. But you see this, council sees this as a stepping stone to maybe bringing some of those artists back to Cape Breton?
Absolutely. And I mean, potentially keeping them here. So we see, again, using the HAT as an example, the HAT Academy that is there now, allowing young folk and older, for sure. We don't want to discount what they considered mature artists, the opportunity to hone in on their skills, dancing, singing, working on lighting and sound to help support productions. This is going to be an opportunity to keep more people home and keep the training opportunities alive.
Do you think that you'll see the arts community working even closer together when it comes to some of those senior artists and someone who's just emerging?
Absolutely. It was spoken of by a number of my colleagues, but they want to see more people from their communities. Gordon MacDonald and Earlene McMullen, for example, were saying, you know, there's not enough people from the North Side on this list. We want to see more people from the North Side on this list. We want to see more people from Glace Bay, from Big Pond, from all over. So, yeah, it's I think there's a competitive spirit now. We want to each represent more artists.
You know, from the mayor's seat, it must be nice to see an issue where council is basically everyone's on the same page in dealing with an item like this.
I said it when we first came together, and it's been a hard year because we haven't, as a council, had a lot of opportunity in person to work together. But we have a council that wants to see things a little bit differently, wants to see support go right back into our community and figure out how we can invest back into our community. And I think this is an example of what you're going to see a lot of in the next 3 years.
Okay, so what's next? I understand there's an issue paper involved. It didn't get the stamp of approval yet. There's still some discussion to be had. So what does have to happen now, Mary McDougall, for the artists to tap into this funding?
Absolutely. So what we did in council the other day was we approved a motion that supported this project in principle. So that is important because it now allows that group of artists to really work hard with the Wren over the next couple of months to develop the framework that will be the administration of these funds to artists. So what will be the criteria? How will the jury, the peer review jury, be compiled? That kind of stuff. So they're going to do all the work, the marketing work, what have you, so that once we get to budget where this issue paper will be presented, and basically what the issue paper is how much money it's going to cost, how staff feels this will benefit the community, and council just has to approve that. So it's really approving it through the budget process, but we've already approved it in principle.
Okay. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there, Mary McDougall. Thanks so much for your time today.
No, I appreciate it, and thank you for your patience and for the for being okay with all kinds of little voices in the background.
Oh, no, I'm sure people will enjoy that.
Okay, thank you, and take care.
You too. Bye now.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.